Welcome to Discover Your Talent to Do What You Love, number 469. I'm creator and host Don Hutchison. Every day I interview someone from around the world who has discovered his talents to do work he loves to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. We created this podcast to provide you with the insights, strategies, and tools to propel your career to the next level. From his towering success building a cellular network, Seth saw the upside, then the downside of ambition. His golden touch became a reverse Midas touch for a while. Gratitude and humility turned him around. I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Seth Buechli. Welcome, Seth.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me on.
Seth, are you using your talents doing work that you love?
Absolutely, every day.
We want to hear the whole story. Seth Buechli is a serial entrepreneur and business founder who has led several multi-million dollar exits. He's CEO of Priority RF, a firm that helps major venues solve their wireless coverage and public safety radio challenges. He's helped bring cellular and public safety radio coverage to some of the most recognized venues in America, the Empire State Building, New York Subway, and Daytona International Speedway. He served and negotiated contracts with leading global organizations such as Nike, Amazon, AT&T, and Sprint. In his recent book, Ambition, Leading with Gratitude, Seth tackles the plaguing question of why ambitious people struggle to find satisfaction and what they can do about it. His perspective, which began in a commune in the woods and led him to financial success, shines through his insights into the advantages and disadvantages of ambition. He illustrates the fundamental nature of gratitude in making the shift to lasting leadership impact. That's a summary of your career to date, Seth. Take just a minute and tell our listeners around the world what you're up to now that has you engaged and excited, if you will, please.
Well, it's been an interesting year. Having recently sold a business, I had the privilege of embarking on something I'd always wanted to do, which is write a book. And so I am just a few weeks into launching and rolling out a book, and that's been an extreme pleasure and adventure. Both.
Oh, exciting. What's the title of the book?
The book is called Ambition, Leading with Gratitude. And the essence that we try to tackle is why is it that driven, ambitious people struggle with satisfaction and contentment?
Oh, that's a topic near and dear to our hearts. So congratulations on that. We want to hear more for sure. Well, as you know, as we've discussed, everyone's life is composed of turning points or passages from the day we're born till we leave this plane of existence. And we face people and events and obstacles and issues that cause us to pivot and move forward. So take us back into your backstory as far back as you will and tell us about the more memorable turning points that have made you who you are today.
Most people will tell me is a strange slash unique background, and that I was raised in a commune in the woods of beautiful southern Oregon. And so some of your podcast listeners may recall the turbulent 60s, where there was all sorts of movements, including the Jesus movement and the hippie movement. And my parents came out of the hippie movement in the Bay Area, and they got turned on to God and ended up in a commune in the woods of southern Oregon. And so that's where I was born, and I spent 17 years there before we left the commune.
Okay, I don't want to roll past this. This is amazing. I was born in the 40s, so I was right in the middle of that hippie thing too. What was that like? Tell our listeners what that was like.
You know, it was a little bit bipolar because in one sense, it was very normal in that there was probably up to 40 or 50 people in the commune. And so there was a bunch of kids and, you know, we had motorcycles and shops and lots of things to do. And we went to public schools. And so I tell people it's not as weird as you might imagine when I say the word commune. But the other side of it was it eventually became a personality cult. And even though they kind of carried an outward form of religion, at the end of the day, it did become a personality cult. And like all cults, experienced, you know, pretty bad leadership and a lot of control and manipulation rather than, you know, what I consider at this stage of my life to be good leadership is when you really want the best for the other person. I didn't experience a lot of that. And so, you know, it did kind of shape me in the sense that I tell people, you know, I was launched into life from a commune and I did have a chip on my shoulder in the sense that I felt as though I was going to be successful and that I kind of needed to prove that.
How was it coming from a commune going into public schools? I would have thought communes were probably homeschool.
You know, I think in today's world, they probably do. Back then, you know, homeschooling's a lot of work, number one, and it's kind of hard to homeschool somebody if you're not really all in for their success. And so that was probably easier, frankly, to bus us to public schools. But, you know, I kind of had to live a dual life, to be honest, in that, you know, I had to focus on sports and, you know, at some point girls. But I also had some teachers that really impacted me. And so, you know, to your point of turning points, one of them that I can think of, which is a really sweet story, is as I graduated high school, my English teacher gave me a journal, and she had given me 100% on a sonnet that I had written. And I only knew of one other 100% she ever gave. And so she encouraged me in a bunch of different ways. And it was fun when I wrote this book, the first hard copies that showed up at my house, everybody wanted a, you know, one. And I said, no, I'm going to give the first one to my English teacher. Wow. And so I was able to call her to lunch and slide across the table, you know, the first hard copy of my book. And so she was one of those turning points where somebody believed in me and planted a little dream in my mind that fortunately I had a chance to pursue later on. So it was pretty sweet.
It's a beautiful memory. It must have been a heartwarming time to be with her. She's so proud she could hardly stand it.
She held it to her chest and said, this is why we teach. And what was beautiful about this is she was like a teacher of the year in our state and well-deserved. But she sent me a note probably a couple weeks later. And basically in the beginning of the note, she said it was the most beautiful gift she'd ever received. You know, yeah. And so that was an opportunity for me to kind of pay it back when somebody makes that investment in us. It's not very often that we get a chance to kind of turn it around by being grateful to them. And it was really neat to be a part of it. And
yes. Well, where did you go from commune to high school to writer? Did you go into school next? Did you go to college?
You know, I didn't. I'm not anti-education by any means. In fact, I've been the chairman of a school board. But my dad, his dad was a professor at Cal Berkeley in epidemiology. And, you know, my dad was a very intentional mentor to me and was also an entrepreneur. And he frankly felt like a lot of people went the educational route so that they could kind of hide out, and that he challenged me to join him in business. And, you know, I debated it. And then I had another turning point for me is, you know, I became a Christian and had a life change moment when I was 19. And I realized at that point that most of my motivation for going to school was chasing girls and partying. And I just felt like pursuing a different path. And so I ended up doing some youth ministry work and then also ended up sliding into what became a family business. And rather than go the college route, my dad had kind of said, hey, do you want to have X amount of money by the time you're 25, or do you want to go to college? I wasn't really motivated by the money, but I never believed the theory that you had to pursue formal education in order to be successful. It just didn't resonate. And so,
yeah, well, good for you, because that's true.
Yeah. And so I had a chance to go into business with my dad and started in a ditch. And we were essentially building cellular communication towers, those towers you see up on the hills or, you know, around town nowadays. Back then in the late 80s, in early 90s, it was kind of new. And so eventually I moved my way from a ditch digger to an estimator. And somewhere along the line, I discovered that I actually liked sales and I liked people. And so I kind of ended up on the front of the company. And fast forward about a decade, we had offices up and down the West Coast and in Hawaii, and we had a chance to sell our business to a public company. And I negotiated to land on the board of that public company. And so I had a third of the business and my dad had 2/3 at that point. And so at 27-year-old, we sold the business and had more money than brains, I like to say, at that point, and was on the board of a public company. And of course, I thought I could do no wrong at that point. So,
Yeah. Well, congratulations. That was a stunning victory and just amazing that you worked through that and got to that place. What did you do then with more money than you could stand and being in a high-level position within a public company?
Well, at that point, I proceeded to convince myself that I was brilliant and that I should become a venture capitalist and I should start all sorts of businesses. And you remember that education portion that I told you I skipped?
Yes.
I proceeded to get my education. You know, I had a lot of experiences. I probably invested in, you know, over a half a dozen businesses, some of which did well, some of which didn't do very well. And that kind of marked another, I would say, your point, a turning point where if I had had the golden touch up to the point of the business sale, I actually discovered that I had developed kind of a black touch in personally, marriage. There was all sorts of struggles and challenges that came after this successful moment. And it was a really tough, challenging time. You know, I had always been the young, wealthy guy, and now I was becoming just the young guy as my wealth was suddenly dissipating.
How long did that last? What period of time was that from 27 when you sold the company until you got to the end of this?
Probably from 2000 to 2010 were the really 2000 to 2005 was the plane is on fire and we're losing altitude. And then it began to turn. And so really I have this decade in there of these, what I consider really hard lessons about business, about life, about what makes me tick that frankly, I don't think I could have learned, but for those challenges. Part of what I came to conclude in that decade was that even though I had achieved a lot of success, you know, numerically and people thought great things of me, that I fundamentally wasn't very grateful as a human being, and I needed to become grateful if I was going to be effective and happy. And so that kind of launched me, and that's the nature of the book is about that process of, you know, always being ambitious and driven, but not being grateful and having perspective about what I should be doing and how I should be doing it. And so, and I don't think I would have come to that conclusion had I not gone through those challenges, but it kind of changed me from that point on to look at life and, you know, my role in it a little differently.
Yeah. When you look back, what comes up to you is why you weren't grateful, or what were you doing that blocked that more, that, I don't know how to say it, the soulful, honest part of yourself that might've been more transparent with yourself? What was blocking you?
I think lack of introspection, maybe comparison. I think I was around a lot of successful people who were doing things that others would have said were great, you know, and so you ratchet up your lifestyle, you ratchet up your social network, and pretty soon everybody's chasing, you know, bigger and brighter stuff. And I think I got caught up in that a bit because I'm competitive and relatively capable. And I don't think that I took the time to appreciate what I had already been given, you know, in my wife and my four kids, in the platforms for influence. And I was just kind of maybe a little bit blinded in chasing new experiences and maybe not protecting what I had. And frankly, I think it was probably more a little bit of my hardwiring and maybe some of the influences I had growing up that kind of created that just unsettled drive. But I wasn't particularly purpose driven. I don't think I understood that very well.
It's really hard when you're on that journey and everything you do turns to gold, so to speak, and you just have this long run of just victory after victory. It's really hard to pull back and be reflective, isn't it?
Yes, but nobody wants to hear you complain about that.
No, I know. Believe me.
Yeah, it's true. It is true.
Believe me. I was that guy, too, for a long, long time. I understand. I look back on that and I think, how could I have missed this pointer or that pointer? Yeah. Well, you can't. It's what you said. You're caught up in it. You're being really successful. The people you surround yourself with they're being successful, and you're all riding this great wave. And even though you're a good person and you wanted the best, still you just missed some basic signals along the way, right?
True. I totally believe that. And, you know, the good news is with a little bit of introspection and maybe advice from others, these are predictable potholes that for the most part can be navigated. I remember one of these moments driving home from the office, and some preacher had this sermon, and he said, you know, you can learn two ways in life. You can learn through consequences, or you can learn through the wisdom of others. And it was just one of those moments where I just thought, holy cow, you have been learning a lot of these lessons by consequences. Maybe you should try the wisdom of others a little bit. Mm-hmm. So
that's very good advice. So at the end of the 10-year run from 2000 to 2010, when the plane, I guess, had crashed, what steps did you take to find yourself and find another vision and a perspective on your life?
Sure. I was kind of demoralized, and I, you know, had this feeling like maybe my best days were behind me because I'd had some pretty good days. And I had just shut down some restaurants because I had been losing money and I hated it and I wasn't very good at it. And my wife said, you know, you need to do something you love, which was tremendously liberating and made me appreciate having such a great wife. And so I had a chance to go join a company that I had invested in, and they asked me to be the CEO, and I was flattered by that. I felt a little bit, you know, I was more comfortable being the guy behind the scenes, the number two guy, and I wasn't quite ready to be the guy, the CEO. But I did the job, and then eventually we had an opportunity to bring in a product from Korea to help solve a big challenge in today's world, which is making cellular phones work inside of large stadiums and airports and subways. And so we negotiated the rights to bring in this product, and at some point we decided we need to spin out the venture into a standalone entity, and I was tasked with shaping that business and building it kind of from the ground up with a little bit of help. And so what was so great for me, Don, is I was basically given this blank canvas to say, build the team, build the culture, figure out the relationships with our manufacturing partner, and, you know, let's go take this thing to market. And so having come off of these failures, you know, I was in a more humbled frame of mind. And I think that gratitude really did play a role in how I approached the business. I felt like it was a privilege to lead the company. It was a privilege to recruit the team. It was a privilege to be out representing the company. And so I took a little bit of a different tack, I think, because I was in a different frame of mind. And, you know, it was hard slogging in the first few years. We really struggled to get revenue, and we believed in what we were doing in terms of doing the right things that would eventually lead to revenue. And so we asked our manufacturing partner to be patient, and they were. And then eventually the sales came, and then we built on those successes. And you know, in the last 5 years, we saw our revenues go from like 3 million to 5 million to 15 to 35. The last year I was there, we were at 58 million. And then we were able to sell the business to our manufacturing partner. And I'm told that their revenues are going to be even greater in the future years. And so for me, to have a chance to lead and to be able to build up a team and to hand it off and to have it succeed past where I could take it, you know, that feels like a win to me. And so I approached it from the very beginning with kind of this sense of, you know, this was a real privilege. And yeah, it was weird to see my name at the top of the org chart, but I also had more confidence because I felt like I knew what I was about at this stage of my life.
Yeah, and much more humility, to say the least.
I'm a slow learner, but eventually I learned.
So this is in the last, when did this all happen? When did the sale to the manufacturer happen?
You know, we closed it, I think, in January of this year. So it was from end of 2007 till 2016, first quarter, that all of this was getting built, and the sale is pretty recent.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
What an incredible story. You know the statistics that we shared, that Gallup's been doing these surveys for 20 years, Jim Collins and his team over there, brilliant people, and they find out when they do these in-depth surveys around the world, all around the world in 260 countries, that when they ask people, are you using the best of who you are, and do you have the support you need, and are you connected at work and all, the overwhelming majority, 86%, say no. And even here, it's almost 70%. 1% of people in the United States, land of opportunity, say they love what they do. I always qualify this by saying, as you just demonstrated, life is hard. It's hard being an entrepreneur. I know that well. And you do too. It's hard being working for somebody else. But still, being underperforming or not in your sweet spot is lamentable for yourself, your family, and for the rest of us. What's that about, do you think? Why do people get stuck?
I think part of it is courage, meaning we all tend to default back to what we know. But if we do that all the time, then you don't get that opportunity to see what could happen, right? And so there's a great book by Stephen Pressfield called The War of Art. And in that, he talks about you have to face down the resistance. So if you have something that's really important to you, or you think it might be important to you, you have to pursue that to its conclusion. And you have to be willing to go through those phases where you're filled with doubt and other people tell you you can't do it. And you have to be willing to risk being a failure in order to find out if what your gut was telling you is really true, right? And so I think a lot of people, they do a calculation and they take the safe route. And I think that there are other people who don't. And that's not a judgment. It's just kind of a, you know, maybe a challenge. So I think that's part of it, is having the guts to do what you feel like. And then sometimes people have worked themselves into a tough situation where they don't have the luxury of taking those chances because there's too many people around them dependent on them. And so, you know, maybe you could say that that's consequences of choices over 10, 15 years. You work yourself into a corner. Sometimes it takes some good ideas and some good thinking from the outside to help us see what we don't see, and maybe see the opportunities that we could pursue if we wanted to.
What would you say to listeners? I think that's a very savvy observation. What would you say to listeners at whatever age and stage of their career about how to take those early steps to,
sure,
to implement some of these ideas you're talking about?
Well, what I tell people that are thinking about career is, I think career is actually an outdated concept. I think at this point, I like to say you should think of it a little bit more like Liam Neeson in Taken, which is, you know, I have a certain set of skills which I can use here. And I think people should play to their strengths, young people should look at joining industries that they're interested in, that are growing industries that are not going to be replaced by the internet per se, or industries that are going to ride that. You know, so you have to be mindful of picking an industry that's likely to grow. And then I think young people in particular, they need to get into a space where they're going to get a chance to do a variety of different works. And as they're doing those different projects and asking for different types of projects, they need to be very mindful on which ones actually make them happy, which ones where they feel like they have good results. And the goal of all of that, including some outside personality assessments and all that, is to figure out during that first 10 years of your working career what it is that you're really gifted at and what makes your heart sing, right?
Yes.
And then I think the back half of that, as I tell people, is now you have to figure out, once you have clarity, you know, you've got good work ethic, you've got clarity on what your gifts are. Now, if you're lucky, you have an opportunity to make your business fit your lifestyle, where you can have a business that you're not overwhelmed with the pressing feelings of hitting payroll, or you're not just working for the man, where you don't get to spread your creative wings. You know, if you do the things right on the front end, pick a good industry, understand your strengths, have good work ethic, you kind of eventually win the right as you get it to middle age, where you can make your work fit your lifestyle better, particularly if you're willing to take some entrepreneurial risks, right? I think the downside we have now is, I think a lot of millennials, some millennials, they want the lifestyle first. Right. And so if you don't have work ethic, if you don't know how to produce revenue, if you don't know what your gifts are, and you start with lifestyle, chances are, you know, you're going to be 10 years into not really making a lot of money and having a nice lifestyle, but you're not going to have the resources and freedom that you're going to want later on in life. So
exactly. Well said. What have been the most palpable benefits in this last decade of your life to you, taking the road less traveled, chiseling out life on your own terms? What are you happiest about? One of the benefits that you've achieved?
I think the benefits would be, you know, a little bit less stress. For me, gratitude helped me realize that, you know, all the good things that are in my life aren't because I work really hard. You know, I try to work hard, but let's face it, you know, I'm born in America. I don't have racial things to overcome. I'm in a safe democracy with a good enough tax structure. And so being grateful, being in a role where I can influence others, I'm starting to transition into doing more coaching of people kind of at an individual level. Long before I'll figure out how to make money at it, I'm knowing that I'm having good impact on people. So being able to see, you know, I live in a small town too. And so I ran a company that had, you know, roughly 60 people spread all over the country, but I ran that company from a small town of about 20,000 people. And so being able to serve locally, being able to give locally and have an impact, that's something that wasn't on my radar back 15 years ago, because part of what brought me back to this small town was I had some restaurants here that need to be minded. I had family from here. But what keeps me in a small town is seeing the impact I can have. And eventually you develop a good network, and it's fun. So
yeah, exactly. You mentioned The War of Art as a resource you like. Are there other books or resources that you could recommend to listeners?
Sure. You know, one of my favorite leadership books is actually Patrick Lencioni's The Advantage. For anybody that's leading a company or an organization, I think it's phenomenal, because I like Collins' work as well, but I find Lencioni's work to be much more approachable and rooted in practical principles rather than research. And I think that there's a place for both, but I really liked Lencioni's work. That one's been interesting. So that's the one that I typically would refer most people to.
Okay, good. What is your personal vision going forward?
Yeah, so I have a filter that I use, and it is part of the tail end of the book, but it's before it was tail end of a book. It was actually something I talked about, which is I want to reach for my potential. I want to impact my world, and I want to leave a legacy. And so as I think about what I do and what makes my heart sing, is if I'm growing and reaching for my potential and challenging myself in new areas, and, you know, that makes me happy. And I do that as preparation for the next two. Then the next two things that I do would be impacting my world. You know, one of the things that I observed about myself, and I observe about many driven people, is they tend to have these grandiose visions about reaching and being bigger and reaching those people that are out there. But we often will overlook the people that are in our immediate circle that we actually touch from day to day.
Yes.
And as I always talk about these versus those, we need to spend more time. I need to spend more time thinking about these. And I look at the people that are in my world. A friend of mine used to call them the cast of characters that drift into each of our lives. And we don't necessarily get to pick those people. I mean, we do to some extent. But the other side of it is that I believe that those people are brought into our sphere so that we can learn from them, and also so that we can teach them and we can mentor them. And so I tell people, be the mentor you wish you had. We all have this vision of, you know, we need a Gandalf to come speak words of wisdom in our life. But we don't realize that there are many people who look up to us, and we tend to hold ourselves in lower regard than we should. And at other times, yes, we hold ourselves in higher regard than we should. And so I think for me, back to gratitude, gratitude helps me kind of get a realistic assessment. And when I'm grateful for these people in my life I've been entrusted with, then I'm more willing to spend that hour over coffee, just listening to them and talking to them and investing in them. And I find for me, that's part of my purpose, right?
Yes.
And then the last one is leaving a legacy. And so, you know, in the big picture, I want to be about making moves, often through handing off my values to people around me, to my kids, so that just like my dad did for me, he passed away in April this year. He had a pretty short battle with pancreatic cancer. And, in the process of spending time with him and delivering his eulogy, you know, I felt like I kind of crystallized his impact on me and on others. And, you know, as challenging it is to look at our mortality, but to be thinking all the time, you know, my legacy actually has to happen now, not after I'm gone. And so to be a little bit more intentional about that, I started a devotion not too long ago. It's called Lead a Legacy, whereas I would normally say Leave a Legacy. I actually think what I believe is it's really leading a legacy and being intentional about creating systems and people and whatnot that are going to outlive us. So
beautifully expressed. Seth Buechele, what a great pleasure being with you today. We so much appreciate you sharing the highlights of your remarkable life journey, and I know listeners around the world have learned many lessons that will help them on theirs. How do those listeners connect with you? How do they get your book?
Sure. Well, landing at Discover Your Talent podcast, we'll give them a bunch of show notes that tell them how to do that. My book is available on Amazon, and I have a domain set up called Read Ambition. So readambition.com, which links to my blog and other resources there. So if they can find out how to spell my name and find out how to get to Amazon, it's pretty easy to find the book. And I would welcome interaction. And I think gratitude is a very powerful antidote to a lot of what ails ambitious people. And I hope that they find that there's some good resources in there.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Listeners know you can go to discoveryourtalentpodcast.com, click on podcast in the nav bar and find the show notes, the full report and highlights of this fine interview with Connecting Points. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We don't learn them. We can't ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive. We thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.